had mine weigh in.
Welcome, everyone. I will call the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue to order. We have three bills on the agenda today. We are going to start by, because we may be losing one of our members here pretty quick. It turns out we have all the information we need to work the estate tax changes, and then we will move to House Bill 2679 as our second item, and then we'll move to House Bill 2543, which is not ready to go, but we will have a discussion of that. So right now, I will open a work session on House Bill 2541. Mazin.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the House Bill 2541 we talked about on the 23rd, and then today you have a number of amendments in front of you as a result of all these discussions. And the amendments you have here is the Dash 18, and the Dash 18 amendment makes an implementation date for the bill on 2012 rather than retroactive to 2011. And then you have the Dash 22, which changes the operating allowance to $1,015% from $1.5 million and 20% of the state value. And then you have the Dash A23, which is about the notification of tax consequence prior to the transfer. This was an amendment brought to us by Senator Morris. The Dash A25 is the amendment that accomplishes two things. It reestablishes the tax rates and the tax table, starting from the $1 million with a zero tax bracket or zero start, which establishes the ramp and takes away the wall, if you will. And that would be at starting at 10% for anything above that million, and the marginal rate goes up all the way to and tops at 16% for the values higher than 9.5 million. And by doing that, we also, in the amendment, bring the natural resource formula into balance by going to the $7.5 million in the denominator of the formula, which brings the amount of credit as one-to-one credit with the amount of the tax owed, which in doing so basically allows for the bill to come back to the revenue neutrality on the natural resource credit, while in the same time continue being the revenue neutral in the rates, but bring back the more stability back into the system. So those are the amendments that you have in front of you, and you also have the new revenue impact statement, and it is for the Dash A25 because those are the amendments that basically bring the revenue neutrality issue back to where it changes the revenue impact statement, and you have a whole fiscal impact that's from the fiscal office for the Dash 18, 22, 23, and 25 with a no expenditure impact.
Okay, great. So what I'd like to do is bring Lane Shetterly up and Roger Beyer and Sean Cleave to just put a little information on the record on in the form of a blessing on these amendments. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much. This is Lane Shetterly, Chair of the Oregon Law Commission and also of the work group that brought you House Bill 2541. First, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I want to thank you for your time and attention on this bill. I really applaud you for the detail that you have, with which you have looked at this. And on these amendments, Madam Chair, we've discussed these Speaking for myself, I'll just walk through them very quickly. I want to say for myself because, of course, the Commission has already voted on House Bill 2541 as it was introduced. I don't have authority to say that the Commission agrees with an amendment, not to say that they don't agree, but it just we haven't gone through that democratic process in the Commission to look at these amendments. So speaking for myself and having been in this bill process for the past couple of years, I would say the Dash A18s that's just fine, changing the effective date. The A22s, again, when we talked about the amount of the operating allowance that we developed in the work group, it was a number that we arrived at really by negotiation and discussion. from my understanding, the groups that are most affected by it are still comfortable with the 1.15%. It doesn't cause me any great offense. The Dash A23s, I think, it's a good common sense amendment to provide the notice of the natural resource credit obligation to maintain that property in farm or forest use at an appropriate point in time. The A25s, that's probably the one I hate to see go away but the most. It was an effort on the part of the task force to raise that threshold from $1 million to $1.5 million. Of course, that did have the effect of raising the top rates. And if this is where the committee wants to go, I certainly am not going to stand opposed to it. I think what the rest of this bill captures in the way of the structure of the estate tax and making it transparent and something that operates in the open, I think is still outweighs my disappointment in losing the $1.5 million threshold. And so thank you also on this, I should say, for maintaining a ramp anyway. I think that's important that we not start with that $33,000 tax bill over the first dollar over $1 million. And so, Madam Chair, with those, I want to thank you for these amendments, the opportunity to look at them and comment on them today. But if you were passed this bill, certainly in my mind, we would still have made substantial strides in making better our Oregon estate tax system.
Thank you, and thank you again for your work and for continuing to work with us as we work through some of these issues. And also, I just want to put on the record that there are many things, many wonderful improvements in this bill that are not the subject of the amendments, right, not the subject of discussion, but will make it a lot easier for taxpayers to understand our system and for our long-suffering public accountants to advise their clients. So do we have any questions before we move to the natural resources folks? Thank you. Welcome.
For the record, Madam Chair, Sean Cleef representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. I'd just like to echo Mr. Shetterly's approval of the amendments before the committee. I did want to put on the record, however, that moving the operations allowance from 20 to 15% is something that the Farm Bureau would like to see stay at 20%, but in all, I think 15% is a reasonable rate. In having discussions over the past week with my members, the largest concern over that operating allowance is when you have a business that's structured where payments come in once a year, there is a period of time early on in your operation for that year that there is a large influx of cash. And as Mr. Shetterly pointed out, that original 20% was a big discussion in the Law Commission trying to find that, I think he uses the term Goldilocks principle of what the right number is. But if through discussions and as more data comes in over this more transparent model of estate tax for natural resource properties, that a issue can be illustrated, we would like to come back and work with the members of the Assembly and this committee to try to tweak those things to make them more equitable in the future if a problem arises.
Thank you. And committee, I've talked in detail with Mr. Cleave and Mr. Beyer here on this issue. And the fact of the matter is that there are situations out there where you have a sudden influx of cash in a natural resource operation. If the person just happens to die at the wrong time, it can, you know, the 15%.
Is there a right answer?
Oh, yes, this is the state tax humor we're having here.
Sounds like the title of a movie, Madam Chair, Right Time to Die.
And so I have committed this entire committee to work further on this issue as we go into the next special session to see if there's some other process that you can go through for those kind of outlier situations that wouldn't be covered by a standard deduction like this. So that commitment is real, and we will follow through on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer, here representing the Oregon Small Woodlands Association, the Oregon Seed Council, and the Oregon Dairy Farmers, all of which support this bill, and all of which would echo the comments you've heard both from Wayne Shetterly and Sean Cleave. My members, especially like in the grass and dairy world right now, dairy probably not so much on that operating capital piece, but in the grass seed industry right now, where times have been in the last 3 years in that industry, when I've talked to my members, none of them have expressed a concern about that provision at this point in time. As times get better and they can get payoff loans and get back on their feet after working in the last 3 years and a loss, they too have that concern about that level of operating cash. And the small woodland owner is the same issue. If perhaps, for instance, a small woodland owner happens to do a logging project and dies suddenly after that, they may have most of their assets from their woodland tied up in cash at that point in time, even though it was, you know, just because they just finished a logging operation. So we too would like to continue our discussion about that, and look happy to are happy to continue working with you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. I think this is one of the rare constants in life where every session we will have something to do with the natural resource issue, certainly every session since I've been chair of this committee. So thank you again, all of you, for your help and cooperation and technical expertise and everything else. I feel pretty happy with this product that we've got in front of us. So are there questions or comments from the committee? Senator Telford.
I would have liked to have seen a dash 26 that just did away with the inheritance tax in the state of Oregon, but since we don't have that, you know, this is probably the best we're going to get right now, so I'm okay with it. But I would have liked to see that next one. I cringe anytime I see a dashes that are above 4 or 5.
Actually, Senator Telford, there was a dash 26, and I don't think we would have liked it. Want
to see that.
We would have not had similar testimony.
Right. I think I said at least on a couple of occasions as I was checking in with the committee on this that you really wouldn't need a work group for that A26. You could do that pretty straightforwardly.
All right. Okay. Other questions or comments from the committee? All right. Folks, I think we're ready to move forward. Senator Morris, we have a dash 18, a dash 22, a dash 23, and a dash 25, and we need separate motions, correct, Mazin?
Yes.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I move the dash 18 amendments to House Bill 2541, dated 5-27-11.
Senator Morris has moved the dash 18 amendments to House Bill 2541. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Senator Madam Chair, I move the dash 22 amendments to House Bill 2541, dated 6-3-11.
Senator Morris has moved the dash 22 amendments to House Bill 2541. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move the dash 23 amendments to House Bill 2541, dated 6-3-11.
Senator Morris has moved the dash 23 amendments to House Bill 2541. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, I move the dash 25 amendments to House Bill 2541, dated 6-3-11.
Senator Morris has moved the dash 25 amendment to House Bill 2541. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2541 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris has moved House Bill 2541 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Senator Hess.
Thank you. I also want to thank and commend the Lane Chetterly and his crew for cleaning this up. I think it's very important for this committee to have lowered that. I mean, what was important to me was to get away from the headline of having the highest rate and bringing it back in par with or below what other states are doing. And I wish we could remove that headline on some of our other tax tables, but that was really key for us. And so I commend you for rejiggering those rates so we're no longer at the top of the pack.
Appreciate that. Any other discussion? Senator Morse?
No, thank you.
Okay, all right. Any objection? So ordered. House Bill 2541 is on its way to the Senate floor. We need a carrier. Senator Morris, you want to fight me for it?
You know, typically, complex issues are carried by the chair.
Okay.
Or the Senate President.
Forewarned. Or, yeah, we should actually sign this to the Senate President. That would be. All right, I will carry this bill. Thank you, everyone, for all your work. Hours and hundreds of hours have gone into this bill, and it's a good accomplishment. Okay, now we will open a. We're posted for a work session on House Bill 2679, but I'm going to have invited testimony up here after we get our summary.
Voting members of the committee, this House Bill 2679, we had a hearing and a work session before. We discussed, this bill makes sure that the Oregon surplus lines law conform to the Federal Non-Admitted and Reinsurance Reform Act of 2010. And we have all the necessary paperwork for House Bill 2679A. Excuse me.
And then there's a dash 3 amendment. Did you want to describe that, Dave?
Yes. So dash A3, what it does is it changes the part granting the authority to DCBS director to go into a compact with other states, and it also requires DCBS to come back and report. It requires DCBS director to consult with surplus lines insurers and other interested parties to the greatest degree possible about the compact that DCBS will go into with other states.
Okay, thank you. I think we'll get more detail from the folks who are here. So let me see. I don't have a sign-up list, so Mr. Marquis and Mr. Kosazan and their clients, if they would stand by. Mr. Marquis, why don't you come first? And is DCBS here? Yeah, why not? I know you testified before in favor of this bill. This is your bill. I wanted you to be here for questions specifically from Senator Morse and also to comment on the dash A3 amendment.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as I testified earlier, we worked...
Your name for the record.
I'm sorry. Jim Marquis on behalf of the Surplus Lines Association of Oregon. As I testified earlier, our association, and I worked diligently with the DCBS folks and the insurance division and Ms. Miller to try to bring language to you that would comply with our statutes, conform our statutes with the federal Dodd-Frank Act. We think that the bill, as written, does that. The Dodd-Frank bill authorizes states, requires only the home state to tax these multi-state policies, and the only way to share the revenue between states would be for those states that do tax to enter into interstate agreements. We've authorized the state of Oregon to enter into those kinds of agreements as authorized by the Dodd-Frank Act. We use the exact language from the Dodd-Frank Act, word for word. We think that's appropriate. The amendment deletes that section from the bill and would not allow the department and the insurance division to move forward looking toward agreements. We think that's a mistake, and it's just a difference of opinion. There are people in the room who, I think, propose the amendment and don't want Oregon to have that authority at this time. That's their prerogative. We disagree with that.
Did you want to add anything, Teresa?
Sure. Just real briefly, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Teresa Miller. I'm the administrator of the Oregon Insurance Division at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And just real briefly, with regard to Section 4 of the Dash 3 amendments, and the requirement that we submit a report, the potential multi-state agreements that are out there are still in the process of being developed and are not yet at a point that would allow the department to assess the financial viability. I'm not exactly sure what that means, the financial viability. If we could determine what that meant, because these proposals are still being developed, I don't know how we would bring forward a report in a few months to you that would be helpful. And as Mr. Marquis said, I think we would agree. We do believe it's important for Oregon to enter into whatever agreement becomes the consensus agreement among the states, because Oregon is generally not going to be the home state. So it will be to our advantage to have an agreement with other states that will allow us to recover premium dollars for risks located here in Oregon. So thank you.
And Madam Chair, Jim Marquis again on behalf of the Surplus Lines Association of Oregon. If I could just add, in the spirit of compromise, because as you know, this bill does require a 3/5 vote, and we didn't really want to take the bill back to the House, although the bill did receive 50 votes on the floor of the House. I did propose that as an alternative to amending the bill, that because I don't think the department nor the insurance division wants to try to enter into agreements in some vacuum over there, that we would add a budget note to their budget, which hasn't moved yet, that would require them to come back and report to the legislature on their activities surrounding these agreements. I've given that language to Representative Huffman, who has vetted it through the co-chairs of the subcommittee that has their budget, as well as the co-chairs of the Ways and Means Committee, and I believe he's received authorization to add that if that would be the desire of the legislature.
Thank you. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As a qualifier, you know, these are complex issues to deal with in a short period of time, yes, legislatively. Mm-hmm. But I was presented a letter from the special counsel of the Council of State Governments with respect to these compacts and how the federal law is now being looked at, mm-hmm, at the state level. And I would like to just quote, if I may, Madam Chair, a statement out of this letter which raises concerns that I think we need to be aware of. And for the record, NEMA, as I will use it as an acronym, means Non-Admitted Insurance Multi-State Agreement. And I quote from Special Counsel Master's letter of January 10, 2011. Based on my knowledge and professional experience, I have concluded that NEMA fails to provide any substantial or enforceable mechanism for achieving uniformity because it fails to provide a binding agreement which preempts other state laws in conflict with its requirements. Moreover, it unconstitutionally purports to vest authority in an executive branch official, for example, the insurance commissioner, to bind the legislature of a state which adopts it. NEMA thus usurps legislative authority because the action which NEMA authorizes to be taken by the insurance commissioner contains no limitations or conditions upon which uniform regulations could be developed or which a state insurance department is otherwise authorized to undertake within its own state. Further, he states in the letter, if enacted, this provision vests ultimate control over what form the state's agreement will be in with in this regard, and the insurance commissioner is purportedly empowered to unilaterally determine on behalf of the state to either enter into either a multi-state compact or a reciprocal agreement. The commissioner of insurance is thus vested with the authority to legislate on behalf of the state. This is clearly an impermissible delegation to the executive branch official of the power to legislate, and then he cites the actual constitutional finding of Springer versus government of Philippine Islands. And I mean, this is a very serious issue, and it just came to my attention after we met this morning, Jim, and what would be your response?
Madam Chair and Senator Morse, I've not had a chance to look at that letter, so I'd be more than happy to take a look at it. I certainly was not aware prior to hearing you make that statement that there were any constitutional issues that have been raised with this, and would be sort of surprised by that, but would be happy to take a look at the issue.
I think Senator Telfer also has something of interest.
Senator Telfer.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Do we have legislative counsel?
We do have.
We do.
And we can bring them up.
Because I have an email from Howard Gordon regarding his now concern of, and perhaps at
Gordon
some point.
Howard.
Gordon Howard. It's at some point you might want to have him comment on this statement that says, I think this delegation of authority may be unconstitutional under Article 4, Section 1-1 of the Oregon Constitution, which states blah, 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 blah. I will continue to review the case. So there is some concern that has now been and it still needs to be addressed on the constitutionality of this. So,
yeah, why don't you come on up, please?
Thank you. My name's Gordon Howard with Legislative Council. You have a question about the statement I made in the email. The reason I was asked to review this is that, and I think the stuff, the information that Senator Morse was giving us was, I believe, related probably to another state's similar provision, but the Oregon Constitution has a provision that states in Article 1, Section 4, that all legislation, with some exceptions having to do with initiatives and the people's ballots, are vested in the Legislative Assembly. And there's a series of the issue that comes up is delegation of that legislative authority. And it's very, you know, clearly delegation in many ways is allowed because we allow agencies to do rules which are implementing a legislation are clearly a delegation. But there are occasionally issues that arise where when the delegation is in question, and when those issues have come up, the test that the Oregon Supreme Court has indicated is when the Legislative Assembly delegates this discretionary authority in an area, the delegation must be accompanied by sufficient standards and safeguards for the exercise of the authority by the person to whom it is delegated. And the issue is whether Section 4, as written, provides those sufficient standards and safeguards. And I was presented with this question yesterday late, and I don't, I need to do some more research before I give a definitive answer, but at least on the surface, there appear to be some questions about whether Section 4 as written does provide those sufficient standards and safeguards, in particular because it proposes to give discretion to enter into an interstate compact. And in looking through the statutes, there are 30 interstate compacts Oregon has entered into that have their terms specified in the statutes. The legislature has approved them. There is one statute, 417.095, that delegates that to the authority to do an interstate compact to an agency. And so with that, that's my research at this point, and I'm still working on a definitive answer.
So what you're saying, our my main purpose in bringing this forward is to try to give the insurance division some flexibility to go out and basically get a good deal for Oregon under this new federal statute. So what I hear you saying is that it might be possible to be on firm legal ground to allow them to go out and basically try to make a good deal for Oregon if there are the proper sideboards and if the legislature at some point has a chance to approve it. Am I hearing you correctly?
The options would be that in most cases the legislature actually approves a statute that contains the compact eventually. Mm-hmm. And in the one situation that I looked at elsewhere involving interstate adoption issues is what the statute 417.095 that gives the Director of Human Services the ability to enter a compact. It does have some a bit of additional guidance beyond what is proposed in this particular statute to the director in terms of what he or she is to obtain in that particular compact.
Mr. Marquis,
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Marquis on behalf of the Surplus Lines Association of Oregon again. I want to point out that nothing in Section 4 requires the insurance division to enter a compact per se. It says a compact or to otherwise establish procedures with other states to allocate among the states premium taxes paid to an insured's home state. Now, I believe that Mr. Howard would agree that the real question here comes down to whether the delegation is a legislative delegation or is this action by the insurance division a legislative action or is it an administrative action? Because clearly it would be permitted as an administrative action, I believe, but not as a legislative action. And I mean, I think there will be varying opinions about that with respect to a compact, but there may be other opinions with respect to other kinds of procedures or processes that might be entered into. And the idea here was to use the exact language from the Dodd-Frank Act to give the insurance division that authority that they might need to implement that act as prescribed by Congress. And then, again, we added the offer to bring a budget note into their budget to require them to come back to you. And clearly, if you don't agree with what they're doing, then I think, you know, they're going to heed that advice, and they would be a little silly not to. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Senator Telfer.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Marquis, given that, really what the Act, it's kind of interesting that the Act is trying to keep us from doing exactly what we want to do as far as skirting, you know, going into the interstate voluntary tax sharing. But beside that, the minimum that we need to do, and you tell me if we really even need to do it, is in order to implement the new federal law in July, what we really need to do is just change the to allow Oregon to tax gross premiums. Beyond that, is there anything we really need to do to adhere to federal law in July?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, I'd have to think. I'm not prepared to answer that at this time. I'd have to think about that. There's a lot of stuff in this bill, and we've been through 6 months' worth of looking and writing and rewriting and negotiations back and forth, and I would, without going back and doing a thorough analysis of the Federal Act and what we've done here, I really wouldn't want to answer that question today. Thank you.
Follow up, please. So as you're doing that, one of the reasons it comes to my mind is that, you know, Oregon has very few headquartered companies here, and if they are headquartered here, they're probably doing business with Washington, Idaho, and California. But those three states have already ruled that they're not going to enter into any compacts, I understand.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, I'm not aware that they have come to that conclusion.
Okay.
That's not information that I have. There's been a lot of information here brought forward in the last 2 days that I've just simply not been privy to prior to
But there's nothing
arrival.
In the federal law that says we have to even enter into a compact with another state. Some states may choose not to and just keep all the tax that they collect and not share it with anybody else.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, even that is, I think, being debated at the federal level and with other states.
Well, right now, the status quo right now is we can tax the Oregon-based companies, right? Maybe this is for Teresa.
Madam Chair, without a bill, it would be clear to me that you cannot tax the full amount. I don't think the division or you or anybody else in Oregon has the authority to tax the entire premium of a multi-state of a multi-state policy. I think you could tax the Oregon portion, but again, I think we'd need some legal opinion about that without specific statutory authority.
Well, but for Oregon-based companies.
For Oregon, Madam Chair, for Oregon-based companies, we would be allowed to tax under the Dodd-Frank bill the entirety of the policy, but I believe that we still need statutory authority to tax that portion that lies outside of the boundaries of Oregon, and I think we have authority clear under present law to tax inside, so, you know, but
well,
again,
how does Texas do, you know, other states that have a lot of headquarters, do they only tax the portion that
under present law they do until July 21st when the Dodd-Frank bill takes effect, Madam Chair. Under the current law, each state has a tax for the premium generated in that state, and you know, on these multi-state policies, the agent or broker or producer that is writing the policy calculates that tax for each state based on the premium attributable to that state, which is based on the liability attributable to that state, and collects the taxes accordingly and sends them out to the various states. But that will not be allowed under the Dodd-Frank Act.
So the Dodd-Frank Act says that you can only tax the companies within your state.
That are headquartered in your state, yes, correct.
But it says you can only tax the portion of the premiums that are in your state?
No.
You can tax the total premium. So if this bill doesn't go into effect, you can tax the total premium, right? Because the federal law...
Madam Chair, my understanding is Oregon law only allows us to tax the exposure here located in Oregon. So with the federal law, I think our understanding is similar to what Mr. Marquis just explained. The federal law only allows you to tax those transactions where Oregon's the home state, but Oregon law would limit what we would be able to collect. We would only be able to collect that exposure located in Oregon as opposed to the entire liabilities in all states.
So if we got away from all the discussion of compacts and whether those are legal or whatever, at a minimum, you need the authority to tax the whole premium for the Oregon-based company. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay. Senator Telfer.
But I guess, I asked that question, so I'm glad we got the answer. But that's really all we need to do to adhere and implement the federal law come July. Everything else, as far as the interstate, the voluntary tax sharing, that's all outside the Dodd-Frank that is trying to probably stop that to some degree.
Madam Chair and Senator Telford, the only thing I would say, similar to maybe what Jim was saying, I would just want to go back. There may be other conforming language that we would want to bring in to make sure Oregon's laws are in compliance with the federal law. And my sense is that there are probably some of those pieces outside the compact issues and those issues where we would just want to bring Oregon law into conformance. So we'd need to go back and look at that.
Okay. Mr. Howard, do you have any other comments?
No, I don't. The issue I'm here to talk about is the delegation, and that's it.
Okay. All right. Any other comments before we bring up Senator Morris?
I do have a question, if I may. In trying to see how this would be implemented in the compact, referenced in some of the attorney's review of the federal and the state implementation. In light of the federal law, they reference a clearinghouse. Mm-hmm. And that clearinghouse would make determinations as to appropriate allocation of the premiums. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? And if that is correct, then I think legislative counsel's concern may be to the extent that you, as an agency, part of the executive branch, would have the authority to send Oregon money someplace else and a reduction to the Treasury than what otherwise may occur just by virtue of delegation to the compact. Something that would rightfully be within the purview of the legislature.
And Madam Chair, Senator Morris, part of the problem is that there are kind of competing agreements out there, and the National Association of Insurance Commissioners came up with some kind of a model compact, and I think Mr. Stefan's organization has involved itself with a different model of compact, and there may or may not be a clearinghouse. There may be. Nobody knows exactly where this is headed as the states begin to talk with each other. There are some organizations, I believe, and entities at work that really don't want to see any kind of agreements ever, 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 because it is in their best financial interest to not have any agreements. It certainly is, that would not be in Oregon's best interest. It is in Oregon's best interest to do everything we can to promote these kind of agreements, because they will generate additional revenue for Oregon, whatever we wind up with.
Okay. I'm going to bring up Mr. Kosazan and his client here, and then we may want to bring you back, so stand by.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Richard Kosasan. I'm here today on behalf of the National Association of Professional Surplus Lines Offices. And with me is Mr. Steve Stefan. And I will make some very brief remarks, and then I'm going to turn it over to somebody who I think knows some of these issues inside and out. But I think the remarks just made that nobody knows is precisely what we're trying to get to. Language contained in Section 4 speaks to an interstate commerce or a compact or some other multi-state agreement. And if nobody knows, and if we don't have a compact or a framework for that compact today, to me it would be prudent that the state take a look at that situation and make a determination in the coming months that entering into a compact or a multi-state agreement is a prudent course or not a prudent course for the state. Because I think it is the goal, as previously mentioned, to provide the best deal, the best opportunity for the state of Oregon in terms of the operation. The amendments that we have proposed, the A3, were not an attempt at all to hinder the bill or the underlying provisions of the bill. They were merely an attempt to address the issues found in Section 4 and additional issues found in Section 8 dealing with the compact, to address that issue and have the state take a look and make certain that they are on prudent footing and move forward from there. Thank you. And as I said, Mr. Stefan is here to address some of the previous issues.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. We opposed, I'm Steve Stefan, I'm with the National Association of Professional Surplus Lines Offices. We represent surplus lines brokers and surplus lines insurance companies in all 50 states in the District of Columbia. And we oppose clauses like that that appear in Section 4 that grants the insurance commissioner discretion to enter into a compact or not enter into a compact for a number of reasons. One of them is the agreement that was started on by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners would be very burdensome for insurance brokers. And in the context of an example, if you wrote a high layer excess policy on Nike, and that's a realistic example, big corporations buy high layer policies from surplus lines companies, you'd have to collect literally hundreds of pieces of data from Nike to put them into a system to try to divide the taxes up. And if the states wanted to divide taxes up, that's not really our issue, but they involve the brokers in going back to the policyholder to gather a tremendous amount of data to put them into the system. And so that's why we started opposing the NAIC's non-admitted multi-state agreement. The other thing is it would result in a tax increase. If you took the Nike example, if you wrote a high layer excess policy on Nike, today you would tax them at 2%, which is your rate, and on liability policies, the home state collects that. They don't divide that up today. But if the commissioner entered into the non-admitted multi-state agreement, they would ask the commissioner to tax Nike at the rates where the shoes were sold and the other equipment were sold. For example, in Florida, the rate's about 10%, and so you would have to charge them 10% of the tax on the sales in Florida, and so Nike would experience a tax increase if they entered into the non-admitted multi-state agreement. And tax increases are normally legislative matters, and some of these other states that did not authorize this legislation did so because it's a delegation of legislative authority. That was a key issue in both California and Washington in deciding not to do this. The other and it's also you'd also have to put a fee on the policyholders, not just would it be a tax increase, you would also have to put a fee on the policyholders to fund this clearinghouse. And so that's not mentioned in the bill, but the non-admitted multi-state agreement would require a fee to be collected from the policyholders. But another issue, and maybe a bigger issue, is we just don't think a voluntary tax sharing agreement can work. We think every state will look at it and say, did we get money or did we lose money? And if they lost money, they'll jump back out. And so we're very concerned about changing software and putting all this burden on the brokers. And the brokers tell us they would have to hire an employee or employees to go out and get this data from the policyholder to put it into the system and charge a fee so the states could try to divide this money up. And so we don't think that a voluntary tax sharing system can possibly work long term. A lot of the large industrial states that have looked at this have decided not to do this already. New York, California, Illinois, Pennsylvania, Maryland, large industrial states are not joining. And the problem for Oregon is there's at least 17 smaller states. And so those 17 smaller states would be interested in joining a compact with Oregon. The problem is, are there larger states that would be interested in joining a compact with Oregon? And maybe the top 20 industrial states have already decided they're not joining one of these compacts. And so Oregon would need to figure out, is it possible for us to do this and make money or lose money? And those are, since it's a tax increase, since it's an interstate agreement, these are legislative issues that generally legislative bodies believe they need to look at. There is another compact out there, and it's a piece of legislation. It's not delegated to the commissioners, and it's been endorsed by the National Conference of Insurance Legislators, the National Conference of State Legislators, and the Council of State Governments. And so the other compact out there is a matter for legislation, not typically a matter for the insurance commissioners, and it was endorsed by those legislative bodies because they considered it to be a legislative issue, not an administrative issue, since it's tax policy. That's all I have. I don't know whether we addressed all your questions or not, but I'd be happy to answer questions.
On the states that have turned down this approach, have they developed any kind of implementing legislation, narrower legislation, to implement the new federal law?
Yes. If you took out Clause 4 of yours, it would be very similar to what was done in California, New York, Pennsylvania. I mean, that clause 4 that does not authorize a compact or agreement really is kind of the difference between what you're looking at and what was done in Washington, California, Idaho, New York, Pennsylvania, the large industrial states.
And what you mentioned, a Council of State Governments compact, a model compact, I assume that legislatures have been approving. What is that all about?
It's a different type of compact. It does some other things in addition to taxes. It has some other regulatory items in there. It would need to get to 10 states in order for it to go live. There's presently not 10 states in that other compact, but I think they probably have a realistic chance of getting to 9 states fairly soon, but they would need to find other states for it to go live. But again, it has trouble getting large industrial states. The 9 states that have joined, Kansas, New Mexico, they're not Vermont. A lot of them are not large industrial states. Kentucky, Tennessee. The problem both compacts are having is getting any large industrial state to sign on. And they're really, I mean, we would question the viability of trying to get them up and running without the large industrial states. How will they fund it, and will there be any interest?
And these are compacts having to do with surplus lines?
Yes. Well, the other one is known as Slim Pact, and this one's known as NEMA. So there are competing compacts out there. I think they will both have issues in terms of long-term viability.
All right. Other questions?
No, sure. I hate to be so dense. But,
join the crowd.
Ask the question, and maybe the insurance commissioner would be one to answer it. But if we're presently charging 2% and you have an excess line carrier that is domiciled, registered in a corporate headquartered in a state that charges 10%, is it anticipated that therefore Oregon would have the ability to charge 10% rather than 2% by virtue of joining the compact? And then you're looking at redistributing those increased revenues?
Yes, that was how the NEMA agreement would work, but it's the policyholder, so it would be Nike. So Nike would have to, they'd have to charge Nike 10% on its Florida sales, and a number of other coastal states have really high taxes because you need to collect the fees and assessments too. And so the Florida Hurricane Cat Fund, for example, you'd have to surcharge Nike on its sales in those coastal states, and the taxes and surcharge amount to about 10%. So you'd have to put a tax increase on Nike in order to send that money through the if you join the compact to Florida and Louisiana and Alabama and Mississippi and the states where they have the high taxes and the high assessments.
Do we know what the insurance fall on?
Please.
Do we know what the excess line, total line coverage is written in Oregon and what that delta would be in terms of increased cost to Oregon business?
So, well, it's a good point. I can tell you that just if we don't even get into assessments, just the taxes, your rate is 2%. The average rate, if you compile them, is about 3.6%. So you'd have to, if you took your almost $5 million in tax and added 1.6% to it, you could start to eyeball what the cost would be. But that really doesn't get to the heart of the matter, because the heart of the matter is those coastal states have surcharges that are at least 5%, and they would want you to, in NEMA, this non-admitted multistate agreement, they want you to take those surcharges too. So you'd have to add, you know, another couple of points to that, but it would only be for those states with the high surcharges. So it could be $3 or $4 million. I don't know what the amount would be, but you could probably conduct a study. But it's at least 1.6% of the $5 million, or at least 1.5 points more than what you're currently charging. So the average surplus lines tax rate is 3.6%. Yours is 2. So your policyholders would experience with multistate risks. And again, that's most of the policies are single state policies. 90% of the policies are single state policies. There's not that many multistate policies. Most of them are a doctor with medical malpractice insurance. It's a vacant piece of property. It's something that's hard to insure. Most of them are not these multistate risks. The multistate risks in the surplus line market tend to be giant corporations buying excess policies like Nike. Those are the ones that tend to be the multistate policies in the surplus lines market. So under any circumstances, your revenue is going to be 90 or 95% if you didn't do anything at all, if you didn't keep any of the tax on your home state at risk, even if you didn't change the gross premium, you would probably keep 90% of what you were doing, because that's today the as-is process is on liability insurance. They just pay the home state now. They don't divide it up now. And so it is kind of confusing, because on property insurance, a lot of times a broker will divide it up, because on property insurance, it's always rated based on total insured values. And this is I know this is a lot of complexities, but on property insurance, when they write a multi-state property policy, they do divide the tax up today, but they do not divide the liability insurance up today. How do you do it? I mean, it's hard to say how you divide up liability insurance. Is the exposure at Nike's headquarters here, or is the exposure somewhere else? So generally on liability insurance, if they wrote Nike, they would pay all the tax here today, but if you join NEMA, you would be dividing that up based on where the sales are. We do have a – I know it's confusing. I'll be happy to answer.
I have more questions, yeah. Mr. Chair, but I'll stop.
Okay. I think we're going to I think we're going to conclude this this work session right now. I think what we'll do is I'll talk to my committee members and talk to the sponsors and see where we go from here. So at this point, I will close the work session on House Bill 2679. And we will open a work session on our other bill, House Bill 2543, for the purpose of considering an amendment, because the bill is not ready to go because of a missing amendment.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, the latest amendment available on House Bill 2543 would be the Dash 5 amendment, which I think the committee has seen before. It would establish a schedule of real market values and that would adjust based on the years in the home in the case of the when the new participants would run up against the 5% cap in growth in participation. There is another amendment necessary in order for Department of Revenue to have a date set in which they would require a certification of the amount of income, and that happens. And there's a recertification every 2 years that's required, and the amendment, the department feels that they would need a defined due date for that recertification, or there could be a issue with appeals. Additionally, it might be possible to put it in the amendment some sort of legislative intent to float the program in the next 2 years. The program would need some funds to keep running in the immediate future, but in the long term is projected to be solvent. The Dash 5 A5 amendment doesn't really change anything about the fiscal or revenue impact statements.
The Dash A5 amendment is meant, we're setting a cap on the program, and if so we're setting thresholds for people who have preference under the cap, and the way we had it before, it would discriminate against counties that had a high medium value of homes. So this was an amendment that was brought to us by Multnomah County. I've talked to our counterparts in the House on it. They're comfortable with it. So we can hold it and take it up later with the other amendment, or we can adopt it now. If the committee feels comfortable with this approach, we might as well just put it in the bill today and then be ready for the other amendment. Senator Morris, okay, I'm getting nodding heads. So, Senator Morris, we're in work session. We have a Dash A5 amendment.
Okay, Madam Chair, I move the Dash A5 amendments to House Bill 2543, dated 5-27-11.
Senator Morris has moved the Dash A5 amendment into House Bill 2543. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. So we will hang on to this bill. Committee, just so you know, the amendment that's coming is something that the Treasury needs in order to give us the... But Paul, go ahead. Paul didn't think I was doing a good job describing this. That's okay. It's not the first time, Paul.
No, Madam Chair.
Still on insurance.
Madam Chair, you're doing an excellent job. I just wanted to just, because I've been talking with Legislative Council about kind of what was needed in terms of language, and we haven't found something that well, we think works yet, but we're working on that, and hopefully we'll have something for you before the end of this week, because we know the clock's ticking. It's the complicated thing is you cannot take something action that will commit the 2013 legislature. And basically, Treasury has some terms in which they would make some money available to the program for the next 2 years to see if the sideboards you've got in 2543 would work and would begin to change the cash flow, and also give us a chance to see kind of how the housing market is turning around. They're willing to do that, but there are certain terms we have to meet and make sure that we meet their requirements, and that's the language we're working on now. There needs to be some type of a legislative commitment that the legislature will be the ultimate source of revenue if things don't turn out well, or they'll be responsible for committing a plan to make sure that whatever money is put forward would be repaid.
Of course, we're hoping that that won't be an issue, that the sideboards that we're putting in on 2543 will be so effective that the program will once again be self-sustaining, and that we will hire armed guards to keep the legislature from raiding it anymore. Any other
questions? I can't let this opportunity pass. Just a reminder of the ways that lack of adequate stability funds plays out. We raided these funds because we didn't have other stability funds. Mm-hmm. And so now we're trying to figure out ways to backfill and correct essentially what became a mistake at that point in time. But the biggest mistake was the lack of any overall overarching stability and the means of creating that stability fund. And in this, as you know, we worked hard in the session to try to create some kind of a package that would lead us down that road, and it's been foreclosed. And this is just another one of those constant reminders of the problems we face when we don't address the elephant.
I appreciate those comments, Senator Morrison. I will have to say that this committee unanimously has been a voice in the wilderness on this, and it's unfortunate that we were not able to get this done this session.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hess.
I think it should be a law that all legislators must serve 2 years on a revenue committee, because I think they would, they see these things day after day, report after report, meetings with Paul all the time. They would quickly get caught up to where they see this isn't some frivolity or something that we should do. It's just something we must do.
They think we're frivolous? Well, we're definitely not. They need to serve here then.
Absolutely. All right. Thank you, Paul. So we will bring House Bill 2543 back. And again, committee, thank you for all your hard work. We're reaching the end times on this committee. The end is in sight. But for now, we are adjourned. And but for now, we are adjourned.